good day to you from episode 28 of our podcast series, Project Breakaway, a metaphorical and literal time in the day when we here at Predator Cycling take some time away from working in the back shop to come and share with our listeners what we're doing, how we're doing it, what it takes to do it, our ideas, our innovative success stories, and even our missteps and failures. If you find yourself with an interest in bicycles, composite manufacturing, out-of-the-box design, or even curiosities beyond, I encourage you to stick with us, settle in, and learn a little. I'm Courtney B., co-owner and project manager of Predator Cycling. I'm here with my partner, RM Goganian, the other co-owner, CEO, lead designer and engineer, and unofficial physics specialist. How's it going, RM?
It's going good.
I was going to say physicist, but that would not be a lie.
That would be a lie.
Also unofficial physicist.
Yes.
Physics. Yeah. Physics. Okay.
Yeah.
So welcome back. We just did a discussion in our last episode with Kurt Chan from ANSYS, and we discussed optimized topology and simulation.
Mm-hmm.
And it, even though it was frustrating because our house audio didn't work that day, but Kurt sounded great.
Yes, he did.
It was a good conversation.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting. I mean, it's something that we've been talking about a lot and we've been working a lot on. And a lot of the tools that we've been using, I mean, obviously we're ANSYS people here, so we use ANSYS Discovery and ANSYS Mechanical for all of our topology optimization needs. But it's been a super powerful tool for us to be able to leverage 3D print into production.
Right. So it's timely. Okay, so our discussion was about simulation and new age, and at the end of the discussion we talked about additive 3D printing titanium metals, blah blah blah.
Yep.
So it's timely because of an unfortunate event that happened during the team pursuit at the Olympics 2 days ago.
Yeah.
During a velodrome event.
Yeah.
So just quickly to talk about the team pursuit, it's on the velodrome, so it's the circle track, and it's four guys on the same team just doing a time.
Yes, so a track, just real quick, is
your event. This is your
oval
event.
Track is my event. I love track. Track,
but you're
is
not
my
a
favorite.
Pursuit guy.
I did do pursuit. I did do team pursuit. Yeah, I love the pursuit. I ended up later, towards the end of my racing, I did mostly the Karen and the Kilo for my event. But the track is a 250-meter basically NASCAR track, oval track. It's banked at about 45 degrees. Ish. In the corners, each track's a little bit different, but that's a general thing.
There's not like an Olympic standard.
There is Olympic standards, but I don't really want to go too far. Okay. It's a rabbit hole.
But all the Olympic tracks are the same.
They're all 250 indoor tracks. And track bikes are special because there are no brakes. There is a fixed gear. So you pedal backwards, you go backwards, you pedal forwards, you go forward. And there's
only
one gear.
Mm-hmm. Like an old school bike. No. Wait, no.
It's like a...
You pedal backwards and that was your brake.
Right. So this is... You pedal backwards, you go backwards.
No
it's a
brakes.
Track bike. It's a fixie. That's what is used to race on the track. And the team pursuit is a special event within on the track where you have a team of four men or women. And you have two teams. You have multiple teams where you seat them. But then when you're racing, you have a team on either side of the track. So you basically kind of like try to catch each other. But you're racing for time. So you have four
was
riders.
Is there a team on the other side of the track?
Yeah.
Well, I'm jumping ahead, but I didn't know.
But yeah, so there's basically a team on either side of the track, and you're basically racing for time. And then once you make it to the finals, you are racing to beat the other person. And you typically you just go from a standing start. It's 4K. So that's typically 16 laps if it's on a 250 track. There's also a 333. So it's basically 16 laps, 4K, and they're going really fast. They're going over 60K an hour average speed. It's about 65K they're averaging, so they're flying.
What is that in miles per hour?
I'm doing that really quick in my head. That's like around 30 miles an hour, a little over 30 miles an hour, right? Yeah.
That doesn't seem that fast, right?
For 4 minutes?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, they're moving.
That's for me. Anyway, so what happened quickly, I'll tell you and then you can tell me more. So the rider in the fourth position on the Australian team during the team pursuit, he was literally just going around the corner and his bars just snapped off.
Yeah.
And he crashed.
Yeah, my heart sunk. I was watching it live.
You're like the only person watching it live at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I think, yeah, it was 3:30 or something in the morning. Yeah, I literally was like, oh my, I think I screamed in the shop because I saw it. It was terrifying. I mean, he's luckily he's okay, but it was just like, there was just like, he's going and then all of a sudden he wasn't going.
Right. So I just watched the video because you told me about it, but I didn't see it because I was sleeping at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
But
one of us has to sleep.
Yeah. So I just watched the video and yeah, the bars are literally just like, I mean, they didn't even like, when you told me they snapped, I thought, oh, they broke in half.
Well, they broke
off. I mean, this is all joins to the
frame. It's a special frame. It's, I mean, this is all like, I mean, we just from footage and what people have shown pictures of, it's inconclusive of exactly what happened to cause the break.
They're still investigating.
It's investigating, but this is also not a thing to like point fingers of any kind. It's more of an exploration of like
to anyone.
Yeah, but and so it's super relevant to what we were talking about last podcast. So like to bring this back up is really
so basically important. Team Australia is utilizing new tech in 3D printing.
Yes.
Titanium.
Yes.
Which we discussed with Kurt.
Yes.
And it's slowly becoming more mainstream, yep. And that's what we are eventually going to start diving into here in our shop.
Yeah,
I think not maybe bars, but titanium parts, components.
Yes, printing. We're looking at metal. We're definitely looking into metal.
But anyways, we are very into the techie side and simulating first, which is why we talk to Kurt and Ansys all the time because we're into simulation for it.
Yes, and I think you know I know we've talked about these things a lot on this, especially in this podcast. This concept of so with titanium 3D printing or any sort of 3D printing. There's no penalty for making things super light. So if you're adhering to that kind of concept, the lighter a part is in the form of being less material, the less it costs to make in 3D printing. Where in subtractive manufacturing, you start off with a massive block of titanium that costs a lot of money.
And then you have to cut it out.
You have to cut it out. So the more material you remove, it costs you more because one, you bought a bigger piece of material, and two, you had to spend more time cutting it. You wear out tools. You wear out machines.
But that's for mass manufacturing, right?
No, just for anything.
Then why are these 3D titanium printed parts so expensive? Just because it's new technology? And the printers obviously just are more expensive.
So like some of these 3D printers, I mean, when you're talking about laser 3D printing, you could be the very basic entry-level machines cost, you know, about $150,000-ish. Mm-hmm. And they go up to about, you know, $750,000. So you're talking about very, very expensive machines. And when you're talking about 3D printing like this and the types of tech that most of these people are using, it doesn't print fast. It prints pretty slow. So you're going to go through like maybe one build chamber like a day. Sometimes it takes 2 days to go through a build chamber. So you could have this part on, a $500,000 printer, and you can only cycle maybe 300 prints a year. So...
But people are going this route because they can make cooler designs,
mm-hmm.
different angles, stuff that a CNC machine couldn't cut out from a piece of metal.
Yes, absolutely. And it's very interesting. I mean, that's why we're exploring it for some of our parts that we've done, like the Genius bottle cage and some of our cleat adapters and parts. So absolutely, it's very, very interesting. But when you start talking about 3D printing in materials, one of the things that I don't want to say limitation, but one of the side effects of going down the 3D print path is time. It's usually not the quickest process, and that inherently will drive your cost up significantly because you buy a $500,000 printer and you can only do 300 prints, let's say, a year. Like you do the math out, it's a very expensive just to recoup your cost on the machine. Forget the material cost, that's really expensive, and sometimes running the machines can be expensive. So it's not,
but it's like the cool new thing. It's the cool new tech because there's not.
Cool.
There's, I mean, not just this specific company, and there's other companies that have released parts and components that are 3D printed.
It's very cool. It's very cool, and you know, especially I know we've talked a ton about topology optimization and optimization of materials and latticing structures and generative stuff, and 3D print really lets you benefit from that. I mean, a lot. Like you can really benefit from that material stuff. Now the you know, physics is only good as the data you give it. Solvers are only as good as the data you give them. So they're optimizing for the data points that you give it. So
So I want to talk about, okay, physics.
Yes.
Design and simulation physics versus live testing of the physics.
Right.
I am a physics skepticist. Skepticism. Am I saying that right? Yes. Skeptic. of physics.
Yes.
Now, I'm not a scientist.
No.
I didn't actually skip physics in high school because it wasn't a requirement. But what usually happens here at the shop is Arm will simulate something and he'll say, well, I did all the math and it math shows this and this will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, okay. And then we make said part in reality. And then, and I know you're like, oh, there's all sorts of different things that could happen. And,
oh, for sure.
But it never worked. Like, I just feel like the physics never works.
Well, I mean,
something
it depends.
Like this. So I was with Kurt, was skeptic. I don't know why this brain fart word is. Anyway, I was a skeptic of 3D print of titanium. Because to me, that seems dangerous. And I feel like I was proven right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's new tech. So, okay. So, again, it comes back to this idea. And yes, and so, okay, well, two things. One, a lot of the things that we test out when we're testing out prototypes are literally taking things to the absolute extreme. So when we do that, yes, we have a higher fail rate than when we don't push it to that absolute extreme, but you got to know where your limits are so you can kind of know how far you can take something.
I think, but to me, my old school mentality is I've got a big block of metal and it's sturdy as hell and I'm cutting from it and that should be a fail safe like that. Yeah. And to me, it's like I'm creating this thing out of metal and I might have thin spots in certain places and that seems unsafe to me.
You have a point. And also, you have a couple points there that I think are really relevant, especially in the 3D print realm. I come back to my original point of topology optimization. Simulation is only as good as the data you give it. And what I mean by that is that software and simulation cannot predict how a topology optimized part will do if you're giving it loads that are not known to it. So, for instance, handlebars.
Even the software can fail. I mean, if it doesn't know.
I wouldn't call it a failure on the software. I would call it a failure on the user not fully understanding the loads in the situation.
But the software can't know everything.
The software only knows
as much as they've made it know.
Well, when you're talking about forces and loads, and especially in stuff like ANSYS and stuff, it will account for all forces and loads that you apply. Now, the problem that you have here, let's take this handlebar situation for an example. You have ISO testing protocols, and I know that this company that built these bars tests to those protocols and exceeds those protocols, which is great. And they do it in physical testing. In simulation realm, you have, let's think about the handlebar. You have a person with their elbows supported on the bars from the aero bars. So you have, let's say, 100 pounds approximately static load there. You have the rider at an angle going into a corner at, 65 kilometers an hour. So you have, the centripetal force pushing against the outer. You have inertia. You have gravity. You have all of these different forces acting on that part. And then, of course, you have the mounting hardware and the mounting, how that's mounted and connected to the bike and the deflection and the sturdy of that mounting and how that's affecting the part. All of these add-ons. And then you have the whole thing of, modulus and fatigue and then, harmonics and frequencies, from the track. So there's a lot of outside forces. And, when you simulate, you typically don't simulate for all of those forces and all of those conditions because that would take forever.
Do we?
We simulate
for a lot of it.
A lot. So when we run the Genius bottle cage, for instance, we have about 12 we have 12 loads that are for the use case of the part. And then we have another 15 different simulations we run to test for repetitive use, fatigue life, vibration, all kinds of other tests that we run as well to test for the longevity of the part. And then we actually cycle test them out. And
that's something simulation can't do, cycle testing, right?
It can. You can do cycle testing.
You can just repetitively in simulation, put a load on a... Well, how would that... physics?
yeah, you can. ANSYS connection. So, but the thing is... Okay, so here's an example. So this is all great. And I mean, this kind of goes down, I think, what you want to talk about a little bit later, but like you can do all of that stuff, but so if you're okay in 3D printing, right, you design the part in software, and then you basically send it out to a proprietary software that's made for the printer so that the printer can understand what you're trying to make, and then it makes it. And then you have to take that part out, and there is a curing process or a post process that you have to do for titanium 3D printing stuff mostly. And you have to clean it up.
So there's like a bazillion fail points throughout the process.
I don't want to say a bazillion fail points. It's pretty digital, pretty far along the process compared to older manufacturing protocols. But
you're talking about like a finishing process. There's a finishing and process. Curing, and that's where all the shit goes wrong.
Yeah, so like when you take So like if you take a belt sander and you start polishing out a pair of titanium bars, and if you have wall thicknesses that are, you know, a millimeter, half a millimeter,
I'd go right through that.
You could go right through it pretty quickly. And the problem that you get is that the simulation and the data that you did was not accounting
for shaving off
that little piece of material there, and goes back to your point of when you machine something from a block,
mm-hmm.
You typically don't get into some of those small, tiny details and those wall thicknesses because you can't. It takes too much time. It's too much effort. The tooling gets too crazy. It gets exponentially more and more difficult to remove that material. So you don't remove it. You just leave it. So you have these areas of like high stress that end up having blocks of solid material.
Right. Well, that's the risk involved with manufacturing that I fear on our end when we release products.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can simulate all day.
Right.
And you trust the simulation.
Yeah.
I trust no one.
This is true.
And so when we get like writer and then we get like for the Genius water bottle cages, we get a customer feedback about, you know, oh, the material's like stretchy or mm-hmm. this bends or this wobbles.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't accounted for in your simulation.
On the Genius water bottle cage, it was. The one thing that we don't.
Or I'm sorry, the answers didn't. Like, it didn't show like a wobble.
It does.
Oh.
Yeah, we have that.
Why were you surprised about it when they said it?
Well, I wasn't surprised. So you're talking about is the torsional twist on the cage.
Yes.
So we test for the forces and act, but we didn't account for what. I take that back. I didn't realize that when you put in the cage from the side and that angle and the weight of the bottle cage in it, it would have more than what I had anticipated in side to side flex. Now, there's no issue on it from a stress point or deformation from having the part in and out or the fatigue life of it. It just gives you this perception that it's loose.
It's just like a real-time comfort issue.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just a user input thing, and it hasn't shown to be an issue at all, and it's exceeded every one of our tests. But we saw it very quickly when we were doing, you know, our cycle testing here of the physical product. We figured that out quickly. We've tried to strengthen that torsional twist, but, you know, we'll have to add more material to do it. And there's no, it doesn't do anything. So,
right. I think that's just my fear. Adding 3D additive prints going forward with our products.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's always something you need to be concerned about. I mean, you always have to think about these things and also need to be thinking about, like, you know, real life conditions and how people are really going to use it. Like, for instance, something that we didn't simulate for exactly, we tested the fatigue on the bottles with a vibration involved. But, like, we only tested, like, two types of vibration. So, like, we didn't test for, like, for instance, if someone used it on a downhill mountain bike,
mm-hmm.
You know, course. We didn't test the bottle cage for that.
What vibrations did we?
We tested for like what we thought would be a normal road, you know, road and like cross country cyclocross type impact and loads is what we tested for.
Consistent.
Yes.
Not like.
Yeah, consistent. Just like you know, like. Rocks. Yeah, like kind of like just like a bumpy road, right. Just like bouncing vibrations is just what we were testing for.
Consistent riding.
Yes.
We wanted to talk about how we keep our simulations digital longer during the design process.
We keep things digital throughout the process, and that's what makes a huge difference for us, because one of the things that we do is we obviously design everything on the computer and then simulate everything digitally. And then we bake molds or we do 3D printing directly from that. We don't, on our 3D prints, do post-processing. We're very careful on how we do it so that the actual part that we produce is the part that we simulated for. And then we have a kind of like a closed loop system. So we basically test our prints till failure in simulation, and we do a bunch of different types of simulation for it. And then what we actually do is we actually print it, make the part, process it, and then we do that same failure test on our testing machine so that we can actually see what happens. And then make sure that what we see, the failure that we get on the part, we actually, that's how simulation predicted it to be. And if it didn't, then we know that something went wrong. Like, we knew that something in the manufacturing process went wrong, something we didn't account for, or, you know, we didn't set up our simulation correctly. So that's...
So because you kept it digital longer, your theory is that if there is a failure, you would be able to better identify the failure either in the manufacturing process?
Yeah, well, both. It's a closed loop system. So it's like a validation type system. It's like someone second, you know, checking your work.
Okay.
So like, we design the part, we simulate the part. You know, did we account for this? Did we account for that? Like, what happened? We assumed that we were making the part like this. Well, then you actually manufacture the part and you're like, well, you know, we sanded it, we did this, we post-processed it, we ended up milling this one part off. You know, the part became different than the part that we actually designed.
Yeah.
Keeping that net part correct, we're not correct is the wrong word, but keeping that net part,
close,
the part that was the simulated part, is really important, especially when you're getting into topology optimizations, 3D print, any sort of like high strength to weight ratio parts, like that matters a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the things that we do is because we're able to test, and we're able to test in-house to a level of accuracy that's you know, very close to what we're simulating at, and we can validate that process and then come up with our own testing protocols to be able to test production parts, is really important, and we can validate that. And so if something goes wrong in our menu, in our manufacturing process, we can catch it really fast. Like, we can be like, oh, well, why did that all of a sudden, you know, why did that deflection change, you know, by 2%? Like, okay, it's never been out of that zone.
So let's play a not so fun imagination game. We have manufactured a part in the Olympics and it has failed.
Why are you playing this game?
Because I want to know, how would we react, respond, check our tech, use simulation to identify a problem? Because what the current situation is in the Olympics is that it took quite a while for the manufacturer to reply and respond to a failure. And the whole podcast is basically how we would discuss our missteps and failures.
Yeah.
And I'm going to future-proof myself.
Yeah, I mean, well...
I mean, we have a part that fails. Okay, horrible. Happens to every manufacturer, probably. I mean, it happens. You might not hear about it.
Yeah.
And I in this giant public setting.
Yeah.
And this, you know, your brand is dependent on how you fix a situation.
Right.
So we've used ANSYS, we've collected simulations, blah, blah, blah. We've found, you know, it's been, you know, less than 12 hours. We're diving into our simulations, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would, probably the first thing I would do is just
hide.
I mean, make sure that the whoever's racing on it's okay.
Well, obviously, but I'm talking about like, from
a reverse engineering perspective. From a reverse engineering perspective, the first thing I would do is figure out what part it was that failed, the serial number of that part, which you should be able to know because you'd know which rider's riding what part, and then quickly look up test results and fatigue testing of the part that we have on our database. See if there's any other part, if there is anything that was out of whack or, you know, anything that didn't match. And then if something did and I saw a fingerprint of something that was weird in that part, and see if any other part that we manufactured had that same issue, and quickly notify those people to not ride on that part.
Right, because it's about survival, and you know.
Well, also, like, I just, you know, I'm gonna make an assumption. There's three ways a part like that could possibly fail.
Physics.
One would be installation, somebody crashing on it previously and having fatigue or a crack in it somewhere that wasn't identified. The other one would be improper installation.
Yeah.
If you were accounting for, depending on how the clamping system and everything connects, it not being correctly torqued or spec'd or something like that.
Right.
That could be another one. And then the processing part that I could see is something in manufacturing process. I would hope that our testing would have caught anything that was improperly manufactured, or like an internal flaw, or a post-processing problem. Like we were talking about, like sanding, removing, machining, something that was done towards the very end of it that maybe didn't get caught if there's a process that didn't get caught before testing, but somewhere there that could go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I would do is go back and try and figure out everything that's in our control and that we have access to on data and go through everything.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's the first thing I would do.
Nothing is a sure thing in exploration of new digital design and, you know, 3D print.
Yeah, and then the other thing I would also do is I would go ahead and say, hey, this is where it broke. I'm going to run a new simulation based on everything I know, and should it have broken there?
Right.
That would be my next thing I would do. That way I would know, like you know, that's weird. Like, depending on where the crack or the break happens, you know, you can know a lot. Like, oh, were we pushing that a little too far? Like, was that like the thin height? That was a high stress point, and we tried to save 10 grams by reducing the mass, and it ended up being higher stress than we thought it was going to be, and it broke? Or was it, you know, a part was overclamped? Or, yeah, that's what I would start doing. I would start diving into all of the data that I have access to until I can actually get my hands on the part, and also know if, like, you know, we have an issue with something that we assumed. Right. If there's an assumption that we made that was untrue.
Oh, I'm just highlighting the importance of simulation.
Yes, there's a lot of importance.
In all of this, you know, crazy.
But also like
3D printing metal.
Yeah, but also world. The big thing too to think about too is like all these things that happen, right? That this obviously is, I mean, it's horrible, but like, you know, it's also a learning experience, mm-hmm. on your product and knowing your stress points and failure points, and building a better product. So there's a lot to learn. From things like this.
Yep. Is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of simulation, 3D printing?
No. I mean, I think I've already highlighted it, but I think one of the big things that's taken us a long time to get just right, and to why we haven't brought out a lot of parts in the last years is we've really been working on this workflow of keeping things digital, of validation, of testing in-house, of a lot of this kind of stuff is stuff that we've been working on really hard. And it's really difficult. That's why a lot of people don't do it. But yeah, it's a process we've been working on really hard. And it helps us make our simulations better. It helps us understand how loads and forces are acting on things better. And it helps us each time we cycle a part to make it better and safer.
That's the goal. Okay. Well, things to mention real quick before we head out. Mm-hmm. The Kiyo and Delta 3D printed cleat adapter wedges are being packaged this week. Mm-hmm. They're on their way to Amazon for fulfillment next week. Keep an eye out on our Amazon store site as well as predatorcycling.com for their mm-hmm. release. We're also experimenting with the release of a Speedplay cleat protector shim plate. These are a stainless steel plate that is meant to protect the Speedplay wedge from the base of your carbon shoe from damage of wear and tear.
Mm-hmm.
And then our available thickness will be 0.8 millimeters thick.
Yeah, so they're thicker than ones that a Speedplay used to make them. They've stopped making them now, but they're thicker than those. They're a little more durable, and they also have a nice textured finish, so they take the wear better. So, yeah, this is kind of an experiment for us to see if this is something that we want to go down the road of. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an experiment for your feet and not for Olympics.
Yeah.
But they're designed around the new Wahoo cleat system. Wahoo is a company that purchased Speedplay recently. So.
Yeah, so this is designed around the new cleat. They made a couple updates to the pedal and a couple updates to the cleat, and this is for the new Wahoo cleat.
Great. So check that out. And then I think that's it. Wrap it up. The Olympics are coming to an end here.
Yeah.
more cycling.
There's some more. Yeah, there's more track still.
More track to go.
Yep.
More fun times.
Yep.
Okay. We thank you for choosing to take some time with us, and we look forward to future breakaways. Look for us on Instagram and LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and in person here in Tennessee. We ask our listeners to please share, like, and subscribe. We're available on all major streaming platforms. Thanks for listening. Have a good one, and find some time to break away.